If you could be on any reality TV show, what would it be?
Oh, my God.
Isn't this a great question as an icebreaker? Oh, my God.
In my younger years, Bad Girls Club, for sure.
Oh,
I almost
fuck.
Went to the audition in Louisville when I was in college.
I should have known that you were going to say this.
But as an adult.
Think about it.
I'm actually, I think, too old now to be on that show. I think it's like 21 to 29.
I can't believe this, but I think you and I have aged out of a lot of reality TV shows. Oh my God, we're
I'm still
old.
Here to play a teen in a scripted television drama, though.
Oh, absolutely. People in their 30s always play teenagers. It's why I can't tell how old people who are 14
are. It has ruined my ability to tell
ages. I'm like, how old is this kid? Six? People are like, he's 17. I'm like, well, if he's been played by 34-year-olds my whole life.
The OC was confusing. Yeah.
The OC really fucked us up, really did a number on most of us.
But, like, right now, if I could be on one... I think maybe The Amazing Race.
I love that. That was one person's answer, which is dope. Would you eat the weird shit? That's
no.
what we all asked her.
No,
we,
I would do.
She was like, that's why you have a partner.
Yeah, I would do any other challenge. I would be like, oh, I'm sorry. I have a bowel disease.
You do? That actually checks out. I wonder if it could get you out of the issue. I don't know.
I think I just wouldn't be selected.
Oh, yeah, maybe. I don't know. This is. Mm.
But what was yours?
I said if I were going to be competing, obviously I said, I was like, listen, it's going to be culinary.
Yeah, I knew that.
So if I were competing, I would want to be on Chopped.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could be a guest judge, I would want to be on Top Chef. But it was funny because somebody who doesn't know me that well in the group was like, do you really think that you could like... make something like some kind of food crazily in 30 minutes. And I was just like, yes. Two other people started nodding when she asked that question. And I was like, thank the rest of you for your support. We had somebody who wanted to be on Below Deck, but only as a passenger, not as a member of the crew.
I would love to be on Below Deck as a guest.
We had so many good ones. So there was Survivor. There was The Amazing Race.
Survivor crossed my mind.
Yeah, I listened.
Did anyone say Love is Blind?
I don't think we got any dating show answers. We proposed
that
to someone. Or
move.
I think somebody brought it up that they were like, I would not do any of the dating shows. Somebody else, one of the other great
Love
ones
Island.
Was there was like some ghost hunter show that someone wanted to be on. And I was like, that's a great answer.
All the medium shows are reality shows usually.
Somebody else wanted to do basically like an investigation, like cold case or like Dateline thing and be one of the investigators.
Damn.
And I was like, also a great answer.
Yeah, I missed that opportunity.
Right. People had good answers that surprised us because people were like, I didn't know that was an option. Also, hands down, and I'm leaving it at this, the best answer of the whole meeting was this guy who cracks me up. And he goes, I would want to be on, he goes, do you guys remember like Celeb Reality, like the Celeb House on like VH1?
That answer crossed my mind. And then I thought maybe I wouldn't qualify, but I almost said it anyway.
He said he would want to be on that. He goes, because it implies
yes!
I've had a level of success before. And he goes, and while I'm washed up now, he goes, I'm like getting a chance to be back in the limelight and make some money again. And people were like, who was on that show? And he named like 10 people, no problem off the bat.
Amazing.
And I could
Tammy
not
Faye
stop
Baker,
laughing.
That porn star whose name I can't remember.
Charo.
Adrian
Flavor Flav.
From America's Next Top Model. Peter Brady.
Peter
then
Brady.
They got married.
They did.
Flavor Flav and Brigitte Nielsen
show.
Fell in love.
Brigitte Nielsen.
Oh my god.
Wasn't Axl Rose on that?
Maybe in a later season.
Vanilla Ice was. For sure.
Yeah.
Listen, we can't live here forever. I mean, actually, you and I probably could, but
and we
also,
did an episode
to
on
Why
it.
Are You Like This?
Sorry, welcome.
And then I get like a little misty and I'm like, should I be caring more about animals than like people?
But it
doesn't have to.
He licks all the beakers and flasks and tubes until he finds it.
No. Are you making this up?
I'm not. This is how it was discovered. Hands-on in-the-field experience to hydrate youths.
Which I know you're like, great, Austin, so you're drinking that fake water again. This month in December, please stop douching your genitals.
Soul-searching to find their true self.
I mean, that is this podcast, so... something we can all enjoy together. Welcome to Why Are You Like This, the weekly podcast where we dissect some part of our culture, human behavior, reality television shows, successful workplace practices, you know, maybe a little bit of psychology, a little bit of pseudoscience, really whatever we're noodling on at any given time in order to determine why people are the way that they are. That is Jamie Ryan still holding out for Bad Girls Club despite the age restrictions in Cincinnati.
And that's Austin Williams wielding some kind of a knife in Chicago.
Heyo. Oh, man. It just was so fun to talk to people about that. And the answers, were surprising.
It's very revealing, honestly.
I think the immediate way to go is you think you have to be competing. Mm-hmm. But then when people were like, I want to be on, Ghost Hunters or whatever, I was like, okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was fun. And people started to be like, wait, does that count? Oh, no. Man, what was it? There was another one on MTV Next. At the same time. Yep, that was it. You immediately knew.
And then there's the Date My Parents one. I can't remember what that was called.
Oh, it was called I Want to Date Your Daughter or You Want to Date My Teenage Daughter. I don't know.
Oh, yes. Something about wanting to date my teenage daughter or son.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the parents eliminate. Yeah, and they were weirdly scripted. It was very uncomfortable.
That's not what we're talking about tonight.
No, sorry, we're
not
here to talk about reality television. We do have an episode of season one Celebrity, if you want to check it out. But what are we talking about, though?
Oh, I'm super excited to dive into this. It was another one of those topics that I was like, have we talked about this?
I know.
And we haven't. So we have here not. We are. Actually, and here we are rounding out season four. Welcome to the grand finale, y'all. Yeah, I'm excited to finalize season four. And so I hope this is a finale you enjoy. But on that note, we're talking about Superstition.
An amazing season.
Cue
now.
The Stevie Wonder, right? Very superstitious.
In my head all day, waiting for
all
this.
All day, all night. Mm. So I'm excited. We're going to talk about it. But I wanted to start off with just an anecdote,
mm-hmm.
if you will.
Mm-hmm.
A little story that is one of my favorite examples of people being superstitious
okay.
in recent times.
Yeah.
So we're going to get there. But there's one sport in particular that people are very superstitious about.
I feel like I should know this, but I don't.
I feel like you wouldn't, honestly, but you will when we get into it. Okay. So let's get into it. Gino Castagnoli is a 46-year-old cement mason, a lifelong Bronx resident, and a diehard Red Sox fan.
Mm.
So his allegiance was such that when his union, Local 780, approached him about the job, his initial reply had been, I would not go near Yankee Stadium for all the hot dogs in the world.
Wow. Okay.
After some consideration, though, he realized that view might have been a bit short-sighted.
Everyone has a price.
And accepted the lucrative assignment.
Mm-hmm,
okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But somewhere along the way, he decided to make a token gesture on behalf of Red Sox Nation.
Oh.
I think that there are there's no sport that's nearly as superstitious as baseball.
Yeah,
up.
Now I'm remembering all of the little rituals on the honestly
sure, pitchers,
the episodes of The
batters,
Simpsons that are baseball centric.
Oh yeah, for sure. Mr. Burns strolling through the gas one day, you know. But rally caps when fans and folks in the dugout for a rally turn their hats inside out.
Oh,
all of the
yeah.
How you have to come up to the bat. I'd say as a basketball fan, the only real superstition-y ritual I can think of is sure people with their uniforms, which I think is true of every sport of the socks, the shoes, the whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the how many dribbles or what you do when you take a foul shot.
Mm-hmm.
That's
you're
a basketball
right. It's
thing.
A ritual
there's a
thing.
Ritual.
Yeah.
Right. Football, I'm just going to feign ignorance. I don't know that much about football because I don't particularly enjoy it. Sorry,
I will
everyone.
Say I don't either, but Silver Linings Playbook has led me to believe that football fans are very superstitious, but that's just one fictional man, so I don't really know.
I mean, and I think they are. I think fans really can be for sure about yeah. watching their team in every sport. I'd argue that fans are more superstitious than players.
Yeah, probably. Well, they feel less control over the situation.
Yeah. That, and whew, we are going to psychologically get into that for sure. But listen, more on Gino, shall we?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Gino.
So as the construction crews were working on the new structure for New Yankee Stadium, this is back in 08, mm-hmm. Gino was inspired to toss a replica Red Sox jersey bearing David Ortiz's number 34 into a batch of freshly mixed cement as what he hoped would be a counterweight to the legendary Curse of the Bambino, visited upon the Red Sox at the time of the 1920 Ruth sale. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but basically, long story short for baseball and non-baseball fans alike, is that the Red Sox sold Babe Ruth to the Yankees, like his contract, in 1920, and then they didn't win a World Series for like 86 years, and they called it the Curse of the Bambino, because the Bambino is Babe Ruth's mm-hmm. nickname, and they said that's why they were cursed, because not only did they sell Ruth, but they also sold him to their, like, number mm-hmm. one enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, it's there a bad go. Look, yeah.
Listen, Castagnoli said, "It's not like I snuck it in there," when he talked to the Boston Herald. "I didn't do any structural damage. I didn't put anyone in harm's way." And indeed, the presence of the buried Ortiz jersey appears to have been an open secret amongst his co-workers.
That's fun.
The subject of friendly banter between Gino and the Yankees supporters on his union crew. Mm. With the Yankees opening up a weekend series at Fenway Park, one of the construction workers spilled the beans to a New York newspaper.
Uh-oh. Can he be sued for doing this?
Oh, listen. So the report of the entombed Boston shirt was aired in the New York Post on a Friday. And by the weekend, Yankees management, pronouncing Castagnoli's prank as a bad, dastardly act.
Wow.
Had ordered a search and destroy mission to exhume the offending souvenir.
It's in
for five and a half hours.
Okay, go ahead.
Listen. And he didn't tell anybody exactly where it was, but then I guess it was an open secret.
This is an expensive mission. People kind of knew where it was.
Oh, listen. So that breaks to the paper on a Friday. The Yankees people are fucking pissed. And like starting on Saturday into Sunday, for 5.5 hours, at a reported cost of $30,000.
Yeah, checks out.
A hard-headed construction crew drawing overtime pay used jackhammers to break through 2 feet of solid concrete near the third baseline. By the time they actually located and retrieved the Red Sox jersey that afternoon, looked like somebody had taken like a machine gun to it, because jackhammers,
mm-hmm. right? Yeah, concrete, jackhammers. What'd you do at work today? Oh, you know, just searched concrete
just
endlessly.
Just exhumed Big Pappy's jersey. You know, shout out David Ortiz. But listen, I'm just saying they were playing a series at Fenway in Boston that weekend, and maybe the bad vibes did get to the Yankees anyway, because they lost on Sunday to Boston 8-5
well,
in the series
honestly,
finale.
Exhuming it is perhaps more negative energy than just letting it kind of lie there.
Totally.
It's a lot of energy toward that, is what I'm saying.
It's a lot of energy. And in a positive note of this whole thing that does seem a little intense all the way around.
Sure, yeah.
The Yankees franchise folks, whoever was in charge, said they would send the disinterred Ortiz jersey to the Jimmy Fund, which is a Boston-based charity for the victims of children's cancer, pediatric cancer, for auction, which honestly seems like the most and perhaps only rational thing that anybody does in this whole story
yes.
since Gino buries the shirt. But in a really positive turn of events, I did check the data, and it went off at auction for the Jimmy Fund and it raised $175,000.
Wow. So, well, it's a piece of history. I mean, it's not just a jersey. It's like
a truly
really, really a story there.
And, you know, listen, they're working on New Yankee Stadium. How far back demolishing already completed work may have set the construction project? We can't know.
I know. George Costanza probably ordered this. Go ahead.
Perhaps. But if they didn't look silly enough already, Yankees management solemnly announced that they were contemplating pressing criminal charges against Gino. Wow.
But what, for what though? Like, what charge is that?
We will take appropriate action, vowed team COO Lon Tost, who told the New York Times that he had consulted with a Bronx district attorney's office to determine whether a criminal act had in fact been performed.
I mean, I'm gonna be vandalism, maybe?
Not even.
I know.
I went through a lot of articles and kept trying to find if I could find information that they actually sued him or pressed charges. All I could find was people saying all these quotes from the Yankees management that they were looking into or that they were contemplating pressing charges against him.
That means didn't happen.
Exactly. I think people were probably like, guys, you don't actually.
There's not a case.
There's not a case here. Also, like, I'm going to say this, like, insert my own opinion. What? Why would you? That seems a little crazy.
It does. But it does.
I will also say, in a bunch of different accounts, some folks said at the beginning of when this hit the New York Post, the Yankees were kind of like, ha-ha, like, and there were some people making comments about, like, well, it's never good to be buried in cement in New York, so maybe, like, F you Boston, mm-hmm. because it's your jersey mm-hmm. down here, and that kind of thing. But I think perhaps the reaction of, like, some players and or fans made them feel as though they had to, do something about it, because people were like, we're gonna be cursed!
Well, so. And if the players believe that they're cursed, like, then you really are fucked, because that will just come true.
Totally, and I don't know that I couldn't find a quotation specifically where somebody was like, we are cursed.
Yeah, but, for sure.
I don't know what was said behind closed doors. I can't know.
I understand the nerves is what I'm saying.
100%. So, I don't know. That's always been one of my favorite stories of all time. The other thing is, and I just want to say this to Gino, and I'm not trying to endorse, like, pulling off things without a hitch, but I'm like, dude,
although, like,
wait,
wink,
until
wink.
They finish construction. Like, they weren't even done. It would have been way harder for them to get the Ortiz jersey out if he had just, like, waited a few months.
Like, before he told anyone? Like,
yeah. I'm like, Gino, hold your tongue, dude. Yeah. I don't know.
Yep.
Or whoever it was who told the Post, because I also read mixed accounts that said, like, it was somebody who was, like, another construction crew member. Other people were saying Gino blabbed. I think there's a lot of hearsay and a lot of schnibbity bip mm-hmm. here, but
you know what would be even better is to not bury a jersey. Say that someone did, and then they're forever looking for it.
I do also want to say that I feel like back in 08 when this went down, that was exactly what my dad said they should have done.
You know what, Glenn? I see you. I love it.
I remember talking about it because I thought it was so funny. And he goes, no, what they should have done is said they buried a jersey.
It's even
really
better.
Convinced everyone. And then they just, like, actually couldn't find it. It is impressive to me that they found it. And there are a lot of pictures of them, like, pulling it out of the cement. So it's like, they have to have evidence that it's, like, the real. Yeah, I mean, it honestly,
little,
like,
brush.
They pulled this Ortiz jersey out. Like, they're, like, opening up King Tut's grave. Mm-hmm. Like, they're, like, live on television, like. So crazy. And you both kind of, from the pictures, get the sense that, like, the construction crew thinks this is, like, funny and jovial. And they're also, like, kind of embarrassed that they're doing it.
Yeah, I think that I would be, too.
So that's interesting. And we'll talk about that. Because, like, why embarrassed about a little superstition?
Maybe if I did, like, I do think that it's silly and kind of a waste of time to, like, undo all of that construction, although I don't give a shit about any baseball team, so I don't know what that feels like.
Sure. That's very generous of you.
Thank you. But I think that if I were, like, a construction worker just hired to do this job, and I felt like I was just undoing some really solid work that had just been done, I might feel embarrassed about that and be like, you know, I was just, like, hired to do this, like, not my idea.
Oh, that's okay. That's fair.
Yeah.
I don't know. Who's to say? Well, on these notes of a good little anecdote, we got to talk about, just, like, jump into, like, that good Wikipedia
definition general
of, like,
deaths.
What the hell is superstition anyway? We're talking about it like we told you, but we haven't. So, a superstition is any belief or practice based upon one's trust in luck or other irrational, unscientific, or supernatural forces.
Irrational is a rude word to use.
It's a little pejorative, yeah. Often it arises from ignorance, a misunderstanding of science or causality, sometimes a belief in fate or magic, or fear of that which is unknown.
Okay.
It's commonly applied to beliefs and practices surrounding luck, prophecy, and certain spiritual beings, particularly the belief that future events can be foretold by specific, apparently unrelated, prior events.
Mm-hmm.
The word superstition is often used to refer to a religion not practiced by the majority of a given society, regardless of whether the prevailing religion contains alleged superstitions.
Oh, you have your own little beliefs.
Mm. And identifying something as a superstition is generally pejorative.
It is. Yes. It's usually like preceded by the word just.
Like, oh, that's just superstitious.
Correct.
Yeah, I feel that. Well, I thought I would dabble us in for just a brief moment because we did mention religion and I always have to pander to my co-host. So I got to talk about superstition and religion for a minute and then we'll get into some more psychology. But superstition and religion, what's the deal? So Greek and Roman polytheists who modeled their relations with gods on political and social terms really like scorned anyone who was constantly trembled kind of with the fear at the thought of the gods.
Okay.
So because they were talking about gods and treating them on political social terms, the idea of being afraid of a god, like such fear of the gods, was what the Romans meant by superstition.
Okay.
And there are some other examples of superstition really being referenced as any excess of religion in general.
Oh.
And linking it in that way, specifically oftentimes with paganism. And in his prelude on the Babylonian captivity of the church, Martin Luther, he accuses the popes of superstition.
Oh,
pretty intense.
Actually, like Protestants and Lutherans do love to accuse Catholics of like doing like dark magic, basically.
Totally. And the Catholics will counter you. So the current catechism of the Catholic Church considers superstition to be sinful in the sense that it denotes a perverse excess of religion as a demonstrated lack of trust in divine providence and a violation of the first of the Ten Commandments. Well, shoot, damn.
Look at that spin. Jesus Christ.
And the catechism is a defense against the accusation that the Catholic doctrine is superstitious.
Let me tell you, it's tough. It's a fine line. As someone who was raised like just incredibly religious, I will say that like when the way that I was so saturated by Christianity and specifically a very evangelical kind of intense brand of Christianity that I feel like that spilled into all of like my like personal thoughts as well. And I feel like I developed a lot of strange superstitions that were not like directly Christianity, but were like my evolved superstitions from the base of Christianity.
Oh, sure. Like what? Do you have an example?
Yeah, such as being terrified of yoga as a child. Being really afraid of like crystals. I once returned a video game that I was concerned would allow me to become possessed. Age 9.
I love you. Wait, what was the video game? We gotta know.
I think it was called like Majesty. It was basically like a precursor to like Civilization. And I really liked it. You just like control, like you were the emperor of like a population and had to like build a little empire. But one of the things was like your people had like different religions and like you could get like magic powers through like some of their like religious buildings that you would make.
Sure.
And I just like really felt that like my spirituality was threatened by that. And I was concerned that that like I could go to sleep that night and I have opened myself up to something. There was a lot of talk about opening yourself up to demons, the devil, etc. And so I don't know that that's like exactly superstition, but it is like an extra belief that I held that like maybe isn't just Christianity, but I feel like it kind of opened the door.
Well, I think that it could be. And actually, if we hearken in this Catholic kind of doctrine, you know, against superstition here, right?
Mm-hmm.
They say to attribute the efficacy of prayers or of sacramental signs to their mere external performance, apart from their interior dispositions that they demand, is to fall into superstition. Mm. So there's a lot of stuff kind of attributing it, and they say like it's an excess of religion, mm-hmm. or believing that religion or prayer has to have some sort of like external performance.
Yes. Yes. Or that like one thing means something else that it might
right.
not.
And so, I mean, this video game, you're like, well, what if I do this, what's going to happen yes. outside of it?
Yes, exactly. And what,
so, like, yeah, that feels like it could be a superstition, at least according to these other religious people.
Yeah. Or like after like encountering like some crystals when I was rock collecting, like feeling very afraid of quartz, then I like had to go into my room and I like prayed for a long time to feel like I couldn't be like open to demons from touching the crystal. It was a lot. It was a lot of thoughts as a child.
I feel like you had a lot of anxiety as a child. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah, you know, listen, just speaking the truth here. So, that's a little bit of our religious juju. We're not going to live there for forever, mm-mm. but it's super tied up in religion. There are a lot of feelings here and a lot of people pointing fingers, so we can't not talk about it, starting with the Greeks and Romans, going to present day. So, there you go. Mm-hmm. But I do want to spend a little bit more time, because of course I do, talking about superstition and psychology.
Mm-hmm.
So this is interesting, and this is an experiment that I had never heard of. But we, I feel like, in whatever intro to psych you took in college or whatever you read in high school, most of us have heard of the behavioral psychologist B.F. Skinner.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And our dude B.F. Skinner, he was... known for a lot of just like behavioral analysis, and especially like the philosophy of like radical behavioralism, mm-hmm. and experimental analysis of behavior and rate of response stuff. So that's like really what he's known for. But here's an experiment I did not know about, and I'm thrilled to bring
to you. I'm so ready. I hear it in your voice. Okay.
Right. So in 1948, B.F. Skinner published an article in the Journal of Experimental Psychology in which he describes his pigeons exhibiting what appeared to be superstitious behavior.
Oh my God.
Have you ever heard
this? I've never heard this.
I just was like, what? Because B.F. Skinner is really touted, I feel like, in intro psych mm-hmm. stuff, that he's just somebody you hear about. He's like, here's B.F. He did all this behavioral stuff. But I was like, wait, I'm sorry, I feel like we omitted the fact that he was studying superstition in pigeons at one point.
Hey, scientists love to dabble on the edges. We learned about, like, regular-ass legit zoologists that became cryptozoologists later.
That's true, and I love to bring that information to the forefront. So, here we go. One pigeon was making turns in its cage, and when that was going on, another would swing its head in this pendulum motion, oh. while others also displayed a variety of other behaviors. And because these behaviors were done, like, all ritualistically, mm-hmm. in an attempt to receive food from a dispenser, here's the thing, even though the dispenser had already been programmed to release food at set time intervals, regardless of the pigeon's actions,
mm-hmm.
so Skinner believed that the pigeons were trying to influence their feeding schedule by performing these actions, and then he then extended this as a proposition regarding the nature of human behavior, like superstitious yeah. behavior in humans.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Now listen, Skinner's theory regarding superstition being the nature of the pigeon's behavior has been challenged by a lot of other psychologists. I was going
to
say,
like, there's a lot of other things it could be, but, like, I love to think that it's because they're, like, thinking that this ritual dance will, like, release manna from the sky.
Maybe. And listen, a bunch of other psychologists theorized, you know, plenty of alternative explanations for the pigeon's behavior. But despite the challenges to Skinner's interpretation of the root of his pigeon's superstitious behavior, his conception of the reinforcement schedule has been used to explain superstitious behavior in humans. Still.
Oh, interesting.
So, mm-hmm.
We get something like infrequently, but like frequently enough that like we can think we make a pattern. I'm sure I do that
nailing
all the time.
It. Yeah, totally. So originally in Skinner's animal research, some pigeons responded up to 10,000 times without reinforcement when they had originally been conditioned on some sort of like intermittent reinforcement
times.
Basis. I know it's a lot. And then compared to other reinforcement schedules, so if you're doing stuff like fixed interval or fixed ratio, mm-hmm. these behaviors were almost the most resistant to extinction.
Wow. So, wow. And we're all doing that all the time. Okay.
And this is exactly what you said. So this is called the partial reinforcement effect. And this has been used to explain
the superstitious behavior in humans. Oh my God, this is why people gamble. Shit.
Right. So to be more specific, right? This effect means that whenever an individual performs an action expecting a reinforcement and nothing happens, it actually creates a sense of persistence within that individual. To your point, welcome to gambling addictions. Yeah.
I do better on the next hand.
100%. Like, we just, it's, luck's got to turn over, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this strongly parallels suspicious behavior in humans because the individual feels that by continuing this action, reinforcement will happen, or that reinforcement has to come at certain times in the past as a result of this action, although not all the time. But this might be one of those times.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, yeah. I love that, that it's like, oh, I always got to, you know, get the lottery ticket here because, like, I want to scratch off here one time, and I've played it like 30 times here, but, like, you know, it worked that one time that I got it at this specific gas station, and this might be one of those times.
Mm-hmm. This is me pulling the lever on the penny slots over and over, counting the intervals of when I have a small win versus a medium win, and then how many duds are in between, trying to, like, predict, and I can't, obviously, I cannot, but I always think that I can because I think I can feel it, and that's not good. That leads to gambling addiction.
Because I think that I can feel it.
Yeah. That's bad when people say they can feel it. Yeah.
Ooh, wow. No, dude, that's real though. I mean, whew. So shifting gears a little bit to more of an evolutionary and a cognitive perspective.
Mm-hmm.
From kind of a simpler perspective, natural selection will tend to reinforce a tendency to generate weak associations that are overgeneralized.
Hmm.
So, if there's a strong survival advantage to making correct associations, then this will outweigh the negatives of making many incorrect or superstitious associations.
Okay. It's just better, so, yeah.
And it's certainly, like, also within cognitive things, you know, superstition, there have been links thrown out with OCD and that kind of thing. People also think that, interestingly, in, like, in a social way, a lot of superstition also can kind of affect hygiene.
What?
You hear about how
washing rituals or not washing things. It's
exactly.
A lot of thinking about the residue of previous times or people or touches. Yeah.
Or, like, not washing a certain jersey
yes,
or shirt
exactly.
or whatever it is.
Wash the luck out, like, of it.
Yeah, 100%. So I thought that was just something interesting
that
to know. Because I'm like, wow, I'm like, how are we thinking about, like, how superstition in some ways is directly correlated to hygiene? That feels weird to say that sentence. But then when you break it down, you're like, yeah, 100% it does.
It is. It does. Yep.
In a recent theory proposed by Jane Risen, welcome to the program, Lady Researcher.
Thank you, Lady Researchers.
She proposes that superstitions are intuitions that people acknowledge to be wrong, but acquiesce to rather than correct when they arise as the intuitive assessment of a situation. So her theory draws a lot on, like, dual process models of reasoning.
Mm-hmm. And
are,
like,
you familiar with that?
Yes. And are you saying basically, like, I might, like, do some kind of small ritual despite knowing that it doesn't do anything? So say that, like, I have to, like, turn my microphone on and off twice before we record. I do
okay.
that knowing that it's silly. It probably doesn't really do anything, but
right.
I feel better if I do it, because at the same time as knowing that it doesn't really do anything for us, there would perhaps be a nagging feeling of something could go wrong if I had not done that. Is that
totally
what we're saying?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And basically, often, like, the two processes consist of, like, an implicit or, like, automatic unconscious process
mm-hmm.
and an explicit controlled or conscious process.
Yes.
And sometimes, because so much of superstition is rituals, well, rituals are these things that, you know, become habits. And
muscle memory, even.
Yeah, exactly.
It's in your
and
body.
So then there are things that I feel like go from being, like, ritualistic to being habitual, just based on how you do things. But people kind of all across the board seem to believe that superstitions influence events by changing the likelihood of current possible outcomes rather than by creating new possible outcomes, which I think is super interesting. So in sporting events, like that being an example, a lucky ritual or object is thought to increase the chance that an athlete will perform, like, at the peak of their ability. But it's not thought that it will, like, increase their overall ability at that sport. They're not going to do something that's never happened. Well, it's that...
It's a temporary thing.
Yeah. Exactly, because it's and likely it's, well, it's within the realm possible of outcomes rather than a new possible outcome.
Yes. This is kind of feels similar to me as when we talked about hypnosis, how people perform under hypnosis usually however they predicted they would perform under hypnosis. Like if they in their mind were ready to like take their pants off or pee or whatever, they'll just go ahead and do that.
That totally makes sense. And consequently, people whose goal is to perform well are more likely to rely on supernatural assistance of like lucky items and rituals than people whose goal is to improve their skills and abilities and learn in the same context, which I think is endlessly fascinating. Oh. I'm like, ooh, is superstition then like stunting you?
Yeah. Yeah, I honestly think it might be like preventing you from giving yourself some honest feedback or like picking up your own toolkit. So I will now perhaps judge overly superstitious people as, relying only on their superstitions, I suppose.
Well, but here's some perhaps positive. I'm going to give you perhaps a positive bit about this.
All right.
But psychologist Stuart Weiss pointed out that until about 2010, most researchers assumed superstitions were irrational and focused their attempts on discovering why people were superstitious, right? But Weiss went on to describe studies that looked at the relationship between performance and superstitious rituals. So how do you perform when you do these rituals, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So preliminary work there has indicated that oftentimes such rituals can reduce stress and thereby actually improve performance. But Weiss has said not because they're superstitious, but because they're rituals. Like there's not real magic, but there is a bit of calming magic in performing a ritualistic sequence before attempting a high pressure activity. Any ritual will do. So that kind of takes me back to like people shooting foul shots. It's the ritual, it's the rhythm. It's like you don't necessarily think it's lucky, but it calms your nerves to do things the same way every time.
Yes, this is even like having a cigarette before you go into work, like things like that. That like, I don't know, I feel like I have things like that that like cue my body that it's time to do the next thing or it's time to do something well. Or it's like time to focus. And without that, not in a superstitious way, but more in like a ritual kind of way, I feel that I often don't feel prepared if I haven't done something like that. And there are things that I like I stretch before interviews and I don't know, other little things.
It does kind of beg the question to me, where do you draw the line between when something is superstitious and when something is a ritual? Because I think we talk about...
It's the supernatural element, I think, for me at least.
Right. Well, I think so. Well, and it's like we talk about the Ortiz jersey, like being, you know, buried in concrete. And I'm like, this guy doing it and the Yankee administration pulling it up, that feels very rooted in superstition. Like we were worried this shirt was going to have like a real effect.
Yes, yes. And I think that if you were truly superstitious about that jersey, you would be concerned about it being in the stadium, even if no one, no fans and no players knew about it. I think you would still be worried that it would affect the games. Whereas a non-superstitious but kind of like manifesting perspective would be that like it only matters if everyone finds out that it's there and that changes everyone's mentality.
Yeah, like that you're worried it
would affect their mindset. Or is it supernatural?
Yeah, it's like the negative side of things rather than like, oh, I'm going to play well tonight because I'm wearing my lucky shoes.
Yes, yes.
And for the record, I do own a pair of lucky shoes.
I have lucky
things. Do you
have
any lucky items? Yeah.
I feel like they're mostly underwear or like older t-shirts that I've saved for a long time.
Oh, yeah, that's real. I feel like a lot of people have lucky tees. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like
lucky underwear.
Yeah, like some lucky jewelry in college.
I feel that. Well, I want to, with this, take us in perhaps, you know, having a little bit of groundwork of psychology and the religious zealots of the world. Absolutely. Into some common superstitions.
Mm-hmm.
Some that we perhaps have all heard of and where they kind of originate from. Because it's interesting to me, like, we all have our own superstitions and we're talking about, like, lucky shoes or underwear or, you know, worried about a specific thing in our environment. But what about stuff like it's bad luck to walk under a ladder?
Oh, yeah. Or like one day, a few years ago, I had in the same day, three different black cats walked across my path in front of me. And the last one was with a snake. It was outside of Eli's barbecue.
I'm sorry, that does not seem real.
With a snake. I wish I had my old cell phone because I took a short video of them crossing the road together.
I mean, thank God. How could you not? Did you feel like you were being targeted?
I did.
Like, what is happening
I
to
did.
Me?
It was the day before I was going to move to California, too. And so it was really felt concerning.
I was going to ask if it felt like good or bad luck.
Medium luck. I chose to take it as like maybe I should just pay attention to supernatural things, not like as a potential warning sign or bad omen.
Well, because you brought it up, I want to address this one first of the black cat.
Yeah, I don't know what it's about.
Being lucky or unlucky, because both of those things exist.
Okay.
So many cultures agree that black cats are powerful omens, but do they signify good or evil? Because we know the ancient Egyptians revered all cats, black or otherwise, and honestly, shout out to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was there that the belief began that a black cat crossing your path brings good luck.
Okay. And maybe I believe the Egyptians more than the Europeans who were burning women.
Well, get ready. So, honestly, strong stance. Their positive reputation is recorded, again, much later in the early 17th century in England. King Charles I kept and treasured a black cat as a pet, and upon the cat's death, he was said to have lamented that all his luck was gone.
Oh.
And people felt affirmed in this, that this supposed truth of the superstition was reinforced when he was arrested the very next day and charged with high treason.
Wow. Wow. That's super not also, the cat's fault, but yeah.
No, but the cat was the only thing protecting him.
You're right,
from his
a
standpoint
thin,
there.
Thin layer of magical protection.
100%. And during the Middle Ages, people in many other parts of Europe held the opposite belief, to your point. They thought black cats were the familiars or companions of witches, and even witches themselves in disguise. And
sucking
black
on
cat
that
crossing
third
your
nipple.
Path.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know that teat was an indication of bad luck and a sign that the devil was watching you.
Oh,
right. Wow. And this seemed to have been a dominant belief held by the pilgrims when they came to America.
And me as a child, probably.
Probably. Perhaps explaining the strong association between black cats and witchcraft that exist in this country today.
Mm-hmm. Synonymous.
Which I was like, I love this one. I thought it was interesting. I want to shout out to the ancient Egyptians again. They really, really are the spark for a lot of these, because if we go back to walking under a ladder being bad luck, that also actually starts in Egypt, which
oh,
I'm like, come again.
They were doing a lot of construction.
Right. And I also love this because these things seem to be reconfirmed several times in history. So the superstition really does originate 5,000 years ago, ancient Egypt. A ladder leaning against a wall forms a triangle. And Egyptians regarded this shape as sacred. Hello, the pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
To them, triangles represented the trinity of the gods. And to pass through the triangle was to desecrate them.
Yeah, just leave an Austin-shaped hole in that sacred triangle.
Specifically an Austin-shaped hole. Yes. Mm-hmm. And this belief also carried its way through the ages. Centuries later, followers of Jesus Christ usurped the superstition, interpreting it in light of Christ's death, because a ladder
love
had rested against, they loved, the Christians loved to take things, because a ladder had rested against the crucifix, it became a symbol of wickedness, betrayal, and death, so walking under it would cause misfortune. And then if we go forward even to England in the 1600s, criminals were forced to walk under a ladder on their way to the gallows.
I was
so
going
that's
to ask about
great.
That. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, this is interesting. I'll be honest, I also read about it being bad luck to open an umbrella indoors.
What's that?
And I was like, right, I got like super excited about this
one. I do it all the time.
So initially, some historians tentatively, again, tried to take us to Egypt, that like surrounded by the pharaoh's sunshades, da 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 da. And basically, people were like, that's unrelated to modern day. Like, it's not about the rain gear.
Okay.
People wanted it to be Egypt, but most historians are like, no. But most of them think that the warning against unfurling umbrellas inside originated much more recently in Victorian England.
Mm.
Here's the thing. Basically, they were like, when metal-spoked waterproof umbrellas began to become common day, rainy day, you know, tools,
mm-hmm.
it was a clumsy spring mechanism that made them hazardous to open indoors. Basically, they were just like, yeah, if you did it in a small room, you might hurt someone or break something. And I was like, duh.
All right. So it's just really not practical.
I know. I felt kind of disappointed.
That
I
is
know.
Disappointing.
They were just like, you might knock over a vase. And I was like, no shit. Like,
I don't know. But you could break a mirror and then you have the 7 years of bad luck. That's a reach, but it's what I can do.
well, you know what? Speaking of broken mirrors giving you Take 7 years there. Of bad luck, let's go. Why not? So in ancient Greece, and this one was interesting because this is some stuff I hadn't heard of before. It was common for people to consult what they called, quote, mirror seers, who basically told their fortunes by analyzing their reflections. And
they're just like standing behind you?
So, no, I don't know if you were like both standing at the same place while you were doing this or you were looking. I don't know. They didn't get into the angles of these mirror
okay,
seers.
Sure.
But historian Milton Goldsmith explained in his book Signs, Omens, and Superstitions that divination was performed by means of water and a looking glass.
Okay.
The mirror was dipped into the water and a sick person was asked to look into the glass.
This is a lot.
If his image appeared distorted, he was likely to die.
It's like the
if
ring.
Clear, he would live. So here's the thing. And then the first century AD, the Romans added the caveat to the superstition that at the time it was believed that people's health changed in 7 year cycles.
Oh.
So a distorted image from the broken mirror therefore meant 7 years of ill health and misfortune rather than outright death because they were thinking you're on the 7 year cycle.
You start over. Yep. And there is some kind of scientific basis to that. Don't you get like a fully new skin every 7 years or something?
I actually don't know, but that seems right. I know there is something about like, I mean, it's a Googleable fact.
Yeah.
Like how many
Look
years it,
up.
It takes for your skin to turn over. 7 years sounds kind of right.
Yes.
And I don't know. Are you supposed to replace your mattress every 7 years? Probably because
all of your skin has come off.
On it.
There's a whole Ew. Body in there now.
Sick.
Sick.
Okay. What about when you spill salt? You have to toss them over your left shoulder to avoid bad luck. Like, what is this about?
I have always wondered, and I knew someone whose mom would put a salt perimeter around their house at various times when she was worried about different things, but I don't really know what it was doing in either situation, like over the shoulder or like around the house.
A lot of this really has to do with just spilling salt has been considered unlucky for thousands of years. So around 3500 BC, the ancient Sumerians first took to nullifying the bad luck of spilled salt by throwing a pinch of it over their left shoulders. And that ritual then spread to the Egyptians and the Assyrians and then the Greeks as things go.
Well, you are wasting more, so I don't...
Well, I know, and that's the part that seems kind of weird because the superstition ultimately reflects how much people prized salt as
right,
a seasoning
exactly.
for food. And actually, I learned this when reading about the salt thing. Did you know the etymology of the word salary comes from salt?
Yes, because the soldiers were paid worth their salt.
Num num good salt lick, honestly. Yeah, I feel you. But I thought that was interesting because it does seem kind of silly. But I've also, I think, heard people explain it in some ways that I didn't necessarily find any true historical evidence.
Is it like I meant to do that? Like I spill it
no,
and then it's like, oh,
like,
whoops, actually I did do that on purpose.
I've heard people be like, oh, like kind of like an offering to the gods kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah,
I spilled it out. I'm sorry. Some for you.
Yeah, something like that. I have heard that. I don't know. Do you have any other feelings about all this saltiness?
I don't either. The person that I'm talking about putting the salt perimeter around their house, I think that was protective. So it's probably a fully different thing. Maybe crystal adjacent.
Maybe.
I really don't know.
Well, and I think some of that perhaps is folks think that, you know, it's good luck. Right, to throw it over your shoulder, like it's
then you take it a step further.
Yeah, do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Because I guess I guess the thing is, it's like spilling salt is bad luck, but then throwing it over your shoulder is, you know, I've heard also like blind the devil or something. Like if it's like bad that you spilled the salt, like, you know, whatever.
And he's behind you, and you're like, like with the salt.
Yeah, and so maybe that could be if it was like kind of religious.
Yeah, I could see that.
I'm not super familiar with salt perimeters, though. I'm open to
it. I'll tell you, I've only heard about it just that one time, though. So it could be a personal superstition.
Well, listen, salt is powerful. It's powerful in the kitchen for if nothing else, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's very important to me. And then the last one I wanted to give you is just one. I mean, and there are so many guys, like, you could spend your whole life talking about the number 13 and why people have feelings about that and horseshoes hanging over your door. And I encourage you to do all of it. Knocking on wood, etc.
Rabbit's
but
feet.
I wanted to give us like a little bit of history about why we always say God bless with a sneeze.
Oh, yeah. Oh, please.
I just thought this one was interesting. So in most English speaking countries, it's polite to respond to another person's sneeze by saying God bless you. Right. Mm-hmm. And though incantations of good luck have accompanied sneezes across all sorts of cultures for thousands of years, all largely tied to the belief that sneezes expelled evil spirits, our particular custom began in the 6th century AD by explicit order of Pope Gregory the Great.
Wow. About sneezing. That's fine.
Again, I'm saying popes are superstitious. You heard it here. Not first, but you did hear it here. Okay. So a terrible pestilence was spreading through Italy at the time.
Oh.
And the first symptom was like severe chronic sneezing. Oh. And then most of the people like often died afterwards.
Shit.
Like, it's not great. Yeah, it's not great. So Pope Gregory urge the healthy to pray for the sick and ordered that lighthearted responses to sneezes, which previously had been things like may you enjoy good health, be replaced by the more urgent God bless you.
The more urgent. Okay. So and every time we hear someone cough part. Now, we should say that.
Well, honestly, Corona times. If a person sneezed when alone, this is my favorite part.
Uh-oh.
The Pope recommended that they say a prayer for themselves in the form of God help me. I'm sorry. I don't know why that's funny.
My favorite short prayer.
I sneeze and I say bless me. Like, interesting. Even when I'm alone. It's a
reaction.
It is a superstition that became a ritual, which became a habit, I would argue. But because I always say bless you when somebody else sneezes.
Yeah, I do too.
Sometimes when I sneeze, I always go, oh, bless me.
Interesting.
Is that weird?
I don't. I mean, I guess not. But you talk to yourself more than I do.
I talk so much to myself all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, that's different.
I was gonna say. I was like, I think it's probably indicative of how much I talk to myself.
I say it to the dog.
Yeah, I say it to Pops.
Yeah, I'm sure you do.
Yeah, you know I do. But yeah, I don't know. I really enjoyed this. I think it's interesting how there's maybe a fine line between some superstitions and rituals. I love the lengths that people will go to really, I don't know, excavate jerseys and all sorts of other neglect hygiene.
It's like what people will do for religion. It's amazing what people will do when they think that they can somehow control the outcome of something aside from just getting better at whatever they're trying to win or perform at.
Totally. And that's definitely something there in the psychology of it all, because oftentimes superstition, to your point, is credited sometimes with people engaging in it because if things feel out of their control, having a superstition that is something you can do that would be causal for the outcome makes you actually feel more in control.
And even just that increase in the feeling of control causes you to relax, like you said. And so then it does work. Maybe not for supernatural reasons, but you may have manifested some shit for yourself.
We can't know. We can't know for sure. Mm-mm. Unless you're burning your menstrual blood making $400.
We'll I'm telling know. You, though, if you do want to do some kind of a really intentional ritual, like magic with a K is different a little than superstition. Although I will say they are within the same Venn diagram, I feel.
I feel like their circles touch for sure a little bit.
Yeah, it's about believing in what you're doing.
Well, and on that note, in true Why Are You Like This fashion, we have to pivot to a verbal game.
Our very last verbal game of season four before we launch into our third year of podcasting.
Third year and fifth season coming at you. So on that note, cue the vibraphone.
Cue it. All right, so tonight I have a three choices with rules for you. So it's going to be a scenario set up kind of like a Mary Fuck Kill. So basically, there's going to be three choices of like superstitious things that would perhaps bring you bad luck or some kind of malice into your life.
Okay. Yeah.
So one of these things, you're going to do it every day and you'll deal with that. One of these things you only have to do one time and then you get one throwaway option.
I'm already like wondering, like without even hearing the choices, like what the one day, like one time thing would be. Because I feel like it would almost have to be like so weird for it to be like an ordeal to only do it once. I don't know. Give me the choices. Well, I'm already skeptical. I don't know.
I don't think you're going to want to do any of these every day. So let's hear.
Okay.
You can play Bloody Mary at midnight and or 3 a.m. I don't know. Have you ever played Bloody Mary?
Yeah. That's where you stand in front of the mirror and you're like, Bloody Mary. Yeah. Right?
Yes.
I just think about how that could be problematic for my romantic relationships.
100%. Or like generally your sleep schedule. But I was always too afraid also to do that, as a child. Or like if I'm doing that every day, I'm like, finally, will she appear though?
I don't think I've ever done that. That is something. Maybe that makes me superstitious. Like, I don't necessarily believe that.
No, I fully don't believe that anything would happen, but I won't do it.
But, like, I also think it would scare me to do that late at night. Yes. Yeah. In the dark, like, try and manifest someone into a mirror. I don't want to be a part of that. That's freaky.
Next choice is to lay in a casket. I will never do this.
Oh, that doesn't really bother me too much.
I feel like in a fractal universe kind of way, it's like inviting, like I'm acting something out that then I
do. I have to close it?
Yes.
Okay. Just checking.
Then your last choice and is to, I did something similar to this earlier today, which is why I thought of it, but you also can kill a mouse with a Buddha statue. So you take that Buddha figure and just
stomp on. That's so irreverent. Oh, no.
Yeah, I killed an ant with a Buddha statue earlier today, and I felt like I was going to have, like, some negative karma.
You might.
I know I might.
Whose life was that? I don't know, but maybe they came back as a mouse. Maybe they're just moving through the... Maybe. Can hope.
All right, so those are your activity choices.
Wow, those are so not great.
No, it's terrible.
But, so I have to do Bloody Mary every night at midnight?
Yeah.
And then get in a coffin with the lid closed. Mm-hmm. For how long? Just, like, what's the process there?
We'll say 15 minutes. Like, long enough to really feel that you're in there, but, like, you don't have to sleep there.
Okay. Where would I keep said coffin is, like, the other concern.
Yeah, if you'd have to have it, right?
Yeah, that feels, like, a little weird to, like, have in my house.
Bloody Mary is, like, the least maybe invasive one, but I don't know. I don't know how you're finding a mouse every day, either.
I don't want to kill anything every day. I would be probably okay with doing that once, but, like, I don't want to do... I mean, obviously, I don't want to do any of these things. I would also be okay with laying in the coffin more so like once than I would. That's just like, I just really think about the logistics of having to keep a coffin in my home. Although there could be some psychological benefits. You know, there is an app out there and some other things that people do. But the app will just like send you like a notification like every 24 hours, like at a random time, just reminding you that you'll die.
Oh.
And people, people live in their life. Reminded of their mortality actually like quells people's concerns or fears of dying, just remembering that it's like always there and a part of it.
Interesting. Yeah, and then you desensitize yourself probably, as the casket might.
Well, and I have like a little bit of like memento mori feelings about the casket, right? But also like it feels irrelevant because I absolutely would like to be cremated.
Me too.
So that feels like a thing. The Bloody Mary thing, I feel like I said it would like spook me, but I feel like if you do it a bunch, you get desensitized to it. I don't love perhaps what that would do for like romance and sleep, but like...
Or you're like at a bar.
Or I'm at a bar, but I think I just like go to the bathroom.
Yeah, and at midnight you have to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, and like honestly, I think that like if I have to do one of these every day... Now I'm starting to think about it. I'm like, do I just kill a mouse every day? But it just feels so wrong.
I don't want to do that every day.
With a Buddha statue? God. If you just said I had to kill a mouse every day, I'd be like, I don't love this, but maybe I could like make friends with someone who had a snake and it could be like,
circle of life.
You know what? Actually, I'm going to do that. I'm going to kill a mouse every day. I'm going to have either like a pet snake. I don't really want that, but I'm going to find a friend who has a pet snake. I'm going to do it as like a service to snakes, or like maybe there'll be an animal rescue of snakes.
Not to
like
shit on this, but sanctuary. The snake does prefer a live mouse.
I know, but sometimes people eat the frozen ones.
That's
true.
People do.
The snakes. Actually, there's a girl I work with who she has a couple little pythons, and she feeds them live mice, and she's like, I tried the frozen, but they just like won't do it.
Interesting. So, picky serpents.
I don't know, but maybe there'd be like a bird sanctuary. Maybe I'd be feeding these to like ravens.
What about your cat?
My cat doesn't eat mice, nor does she kill them. Sometimes it's a lot to get her to kill them. Like, no, it's like, I wish she would, like, kill spiders. Sometimes she just kind of plays with them.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So I'm like, Poppy, you're not helping here. I mean, she's great. Okay, well, anyway. So, actually, I think I'm going to find a way to, like, make it positive and, like, a positive offering to the animal kingdom and community of killing the mouse. Then I'll just do Bloody Mary once.
Okay.
And then I'm not going to lay in the coffin.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I really thought I was going to do Bloody Mary every night, just like in the bathroom. just like wherever
I was. While you're putting your skincare stuff on?
Yeah, maybe. Like, I don't know. Or just like, you know, just make a quick beeline to the loo, get my Bloody Mary.
What if it's a public restroom at a bar? And there's other people in there. What if there's a line?
It's like stalls and one mirror.
Yeah.
How loud do you have to say Bloody Mary to be yelling it? Or people would just be like, man, this girl's always wasted in the bathrooms. I don't know. Would you do something different?
I thought that I would never, ever lay in a casket because I feel it's inviting some bad things. But given this list that I created, I think that I would have to have a casket in my house that I would like get in at some point each day during the day. And I would have to try to think of it as like a sensory deprivation meditation, you know?
Yeah.
Because
I was so offended by the aesthetics. I was like, what is this, Harold and Maude and I'm Bud Cort and I have to have a coffin in my house?
Exactly. And then I'm like, do I keep it in the basement? And I'm like, but it's so much scarier if it's in the basement. So no,
right.
But I don't want it out. But I don't know. I'll have to figure that out. So
decorate it and tell guests it was a tanning bed.
Oh my God. That's a great idea. Well, I don't want to be perceived as owning a tanning bed.
That's also problematic. Yep. Mm-hmm. But like, what seems worse, owning a coffin or owning a tanning bed?
I really don't know. They're both deathbeds, if you will. But
they are both deathbeds. That's fair.
But one is warm and bright. Anyway, I couldn't kill a mouse with a Buddha, I don't think. I think I just couldn't. So I'd rather do Bloody Mary one time, but I can't do Bloody Mary or kill a mouse every day. So that's why I have to have the coffin in my house.
Wow. I mean, I feel like, though, your aesthetic is so much more rock and roll. You could, like, I feel like you have a personality that you could, like, get away with having a coffin. Like, and I mean this affectionately.
No, I actually feel like picturing it in my living room and it, like,
see it.
It's, like, not
working.
And I feel
like people who are friends with you, like, if you just all of a sudden had a coffin as part of decor, like, people wouldn't question it. We'd be like, yeah, Jamie would do that. But if I had a coffin, people would be like, is she okay?
No, you're right.
What's happening there?
You're right.
But if you had a coffin, people would be like, checks out.
Yeah.
Which is funny because I think you are inherently more scared of it than I am.
100%. I am definitely more scared of it. But aesthetically, it checks out. I like to do a lot of projects. You never know what kind of love seat I'm trying to make with that coffin.
Shout out to Bud Cort. You'd be like making Harold's furniture. I don't even know.
I bet there's a market for that. There's probably Etsy furniture made from coffins.
Oh, there absolutely is Etsy furniture made from coffins.
Yeah. If not, Museum Man. Of Death, get at me.
Honestly. Listen, Etsy should sponsor this show. I'm just saying, the amount of times we talk about, like, how you could buy ayahuasca on Etsy.
We are constantly about the promoting.
Coffin furniture. Listen,
it's integrated people, marketing. Mm-hmm.
Integrated marketing. Etsy, this is hypnotic. We've actually just been playing the word Etsy backwards throughout this entire podcast at a very low frequency.
Yep.
What if?
Yeah. I could see us doing that. I think it's probably my voice saying it quietly. I don't know. We could try it sometimes. No, that's irresponsible and I won't do that. I'm sorry, everyone.
If you two think that you could see us subliminally messaging you about Etsy, let us know. As always, you can find us on the internet via email at whyareyoulikethispod@gmail.com, on Instagram at whyareyoulikethispod, and on Twitter at @WAYLTTweets. And good day, good morning, good night, good luck. Enjoy your... You know how they had like 7 minutes in heaven? We'll be like, enjoy the 15 and the caffeine.
Oh,
we'll
yeah. Have to work on that. That's great. Mm-hmm. That's great. And if you work for Etsy and you want to discuss the... campaign, please get at me.
Absolutely.
Bye. That's all.
Bye.